Morning, everybody. My name is Ralph White. I am an alcoholic. And welcome back this morning. Where we left off last night, and I think I want to thank Kent. I got so much from listening to him last night. And where we left off last night was we both discussed what brought us to the point of actually meeting you. Not specifically the people in here, but meeting the people in the fellowship. And that business of powerlessness and unmanageability, we talked about the problem. So, Mr. White, what about this solution? Our second step, this coming to believe deal. And what was that like for you? And then the primary place that we talk about it in our program is in our chapter, We Agnostics. And that was, I think, depending on where you catch me, what day you catch me, and what I'm doing, I got a lot of steps. This is my favorite step. And I got a lot of chapters. This is my favorite chapter, you know. I grew up in Baptist church. And Baptist church is a little different. My experience and our experiences, I'm sure, even in here are varied in terms of religious background, if, as it were. And some people might have had none at all. Some people might be staunch atheists. My friend, the late Leon Strange, used to say, he would have been an atheist, but it took too much work. You know, you gotta be able to hold up your end of the argument for that one. You gotta be able to argue there ain't no God. You know, too much work. Anyway, and then you have people, you know, all over the spectrum who've had religious education. And I'm one of the people that came from a Baptist background. I grew up in Los Angeles, but a bunch of folk had migrated, you know, to Los Angeles. And my mom was part of a group of folk who had migrated. And so the churches we attended, you know, were Southern Baptist Church. And that's a little different than a Catholic experience, I would imagine. I've been to Catholic churches. First time I had said, there was so much that's happened to me as a result of getting sober, you know, when I think about it. In addition to a new life, I'm the kind of guy, you guys, I'm always curious. I'm always interested in learning and knowing. So there have been some other avenues that have opened up for me in addition to just the road to recovery, because I'm a curious guy. I sponsor a lot of people. I meet a lot of people. So I've learned a lot of different things that I never knew before. So I visited, I first visited Catholic Church. As a result of being sober, burying a couple of sponsees, it was the very first time I stepped in a Catholic church. And over the years, I've had occasion to be back in a number of times. Never been to a service. Leslie and I were talking about that. I think I want to go to a service. I've been to Catholic church funerals. And that's, you know, a really solemn experience. It's up, down, up, down. I'm like, oh my God, this is a lot of up, down, you know. It's, you know, solemn, kind of awe-inspiring. If you've not been to a Baptist church and you have a Catholic background, you know, the Baptist experience is a bit different. High energy, you know, it's singing. When I was a kid growing up in particular, at a certain point in the proceedings, apparently, it never happened to me, but apparently this thing, the Holy Ghost, would go through the church and folk might be moved to jump up. And I was 8 years old looking at my mom out the side of my, like, you better not jump up in here and embarrass me. You know, I'm eight. I've been selfish and self. I've been self-centered as long as I can remember. You know, as long as I can remember. Not saying that I've had this level all my life, but as long as I can remember, I've been acutely aware of how I think I'm being perceived. And everything in my environment reflects me, my mama. you better not jump up in here and embarrass me. She's putting food on the table. She's the breadwinner. She's got six boys. She's on welfare. She's taking care of, but this is me, right? And so Baptist church, the way that they describe things in church for me was myths, fables. My boy Steve Lee talked about, you might as well be reading Jack and the Beanstalk as to be reading, you know, all that stuff is, that's how I looked at it. Daniel in the lion's den, Jonah in the whale's belly, Moses parting the Red Sea. Come on, miss me with that. Religion is, you know, religion is opiate of the people. I'd rather smoke mine. Thank you very much. You know, that's what I used to say. So I'm growing up, I'm cynic, I'm skeptic, I'm scoffer. You know, you gave me another name, you call me agnostic. You know, and so I came into this experience, but I was tenderized. Anybody that's having a really difficult accepting stuff experience, remember what I said we're going to put on that board? If it ain't my experience, you're lying about it being yours. I used to sometimes think, oh, man, come on, it ain't that serious. But there are people who really grow up with some hurdles and some difficulties in this area. For me, with that well-whooped ass that I came in here with, I had been, you know, really tenderized to be doomed to die an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis, and not always, I got it, you know, I got that one. I still was looking for door number three. It's got to be something other than spiritual experience and alcoholic death, you know. Come on, you know. When I look back on my experience, to be honest, when I first stepped into, I'm not in the treatment program, when I first stepped in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I told you last night, my first meeting, I used to go to this group, the Log Cabin in West Los Angeles, but my home group, when I first stepped into 9604, and I stood in a circle with you guys, it felt like coming home. And isn't it interesting? You know, we talk a lot about, when I read that sentence, you know, you work on the spiritual and the mental and the physical is straightened out. That used to puzzle me. It didn't, and it seemed counterintuitive. It didn't seem right. It seemed, wait, hold up. What do you mean we straighten out spiritually? You know, we work on spiritual and then we straighten out physically and mentally. The physical seemed like it happened first. You know, I was in Harbor Light, I was eating some meals, you know, I got some weight back on, I got, you know, your skin clears up, you cut your hair, you start looking better, you start feeling, seems like that comes first. Then it felt like this mental, I'm not doing as many, you know, off the wall things, and then it seemed like the spiritual was a long, slow process. But when you think about it, when you think about this spiritual path that we're on, and you think about sometimes I discount the power of grace. Sometimes I really do it a disservice, even now. I like to think that I surrendered, and I'm not the surrendering kind. I'm not the surrendering type. In either one of the dictionary definitions, surrender is to give up. I give. I don't do that. I give lip service to it. Okay, I give. Get up off me, and when you turn your back, I hit you in the back of the head, or I jump up and I try something else again, or I get revived. And I also don't surrender in the other sense. I don't surrender my stuff. I don't surrender my possessions. I don't surrender my. I'm not the surrendering type. So I'm not the guy that said I will surrender. And the depth of that surrender, the longer I'm around, the more I appreciate that something happened to and through me, not of me. I like to think I threw it up. But I was getting loaded from the time I was 18 till the time I was 33. And I couldn't put it down. I didn't try to. The other difficulty I had with the second step was I hear a lot of people say in their experience they had looked at how many times they tried to stop on their own and they couldn't. Well, I didn't have a bank of experience for that. I never tried to stop. Never tried to stop on my own. I tried to stop spending my whole paycheck. I had tried to stop missing work. I tried to stop getting sweated at home by my wife because I didn't make it home with a check. I tried to stop the external consequences, you guys. And then there was a subset of that. I tried to stop the consequences of this one aspect of what I was doing, the smoking. I never tried to stop drinking, and I thought I'd be smoking weed in a rocking chair. You know, I thought I'd be a cool granddaddy smoking weed with my grandson, you know. I really did, you know, I really, really did. Some of it, you know, I think stronger than denial is delusion. And because some of that I just really believed. And so this business of trying to stop on my own and being unsuccessful, I didn't have experience with that. I had never done that. And so I approached this whole business of this coming to believe deal, man, for me. And I'm gonna talk about my experience as it relates to what I saw in here, but I'm talking about Ralph's experience. It's not everybody's. I didn't realize how much that standing up in church every Sunday morning, the Sunday school, the BTU, the evening service, the stand up and recite the stuff, and because the white boys, me and my brothers, my name Ralph White, we would be the ones in front of the church on Christmas and Easter, because we good students and we scholar and we recite well, and yeah, mother, what Mr. White just, you know, and I didn't realize how much of that was the spirit of it, you know. I didn't realize how much of that was going home to me. Just as an aside, when I go sit in the church now, and I've not returned to church per se. I don't have a regular church practice. That's just, but when I go, and I was in church not that long ago, they were honoring my mom. It feels like coming home to me. Never. That was an unanticipated deal, you know. So this business of this power calling, you know, I didn't know. So you, but going back to what I said originally about the spiritual seeming to happen first. So I was surrendered, and well surrendered. I had stopped a number of times before, right? Serious consequences. This close to being put out the house, you know, this close. I had gone in a bank account we had. We were saving for our first house, and we had got a piece of money, and I think maybe some tax. So we had $10,000 in the bank, the year of 1984, and we had this money in the bank. And ATMs had just hit the scene, right? For some of you youngsters, you don't realize that there was a time when if you didn't go to the bank on Friday before 5 o'clock, you didn't have no money for the weekend. You couldn't just go get money from the bank like you can now. You had to go get money before the bank closed. Then ATMs came out and you could get. My wife at this time made the serious mistake of giving her husband, who she married and should have been able to trust, this ATM card to go get some milk this particular night for our infant daughter. And the PIN number, obviously. So from that point on, I had access to that ATM card. She turned her back, I go in the purse, and more importantly, I knew the PIN. And when you hit 10,000 and you take $60, ain't no big thing. And when you hit 10,000 and it's 8,400, it still ain't a big thing. But when you look up about a month and a half into this, and it's down to 2,400, you start going, ooh. And then, and the day comes when you're sitting on the bed, getting ready to go to work, and of course you guys are down to one car, because you living with me, and that's the consequence of living with me. We down the one car and we sharing that car. She would drop me off at work. I worked in Alhambra, which was about 45 minutes from LA, and she worked in Hollywood, and she'd drop me off and then she'd go to work. And we were getting ready to go to work this morning, and you're sitting on the bed and she says, have you been going in the ATM? No. Oh, okay. Well, something has been happening with the bank. And I called down to the bank manager. The manager called me at work yesterday and said, come down today. They have pictures of who's been going in the ATM. I didn't know they were taking pictures. This is ATMs were new at the time. And I was on thin ice already. And I knew, don't let a woman school, I mean, that's living with one of us get blindsided. And, you know, I'm going to jail if I get blind. Oh, go get his ass, you know. I know it. I know my wife at the time. So I'd say, I can't let her. So I'm sitting on the bed and I'm like, I took the money. What? I took the money. You guys, to this day, I don't know how I'm here talking to you guys. I really can't remember what, but you can imagine the longest trip ever to work, the longest, you know. So I was like, oh my God. So this business of being entirely, you know, wore out when I came here, you guys, I had quit before. That was 84. I didn't get sober till 86. I got scared then, and I stopped for a little while. But I started up again, just like Ken. Whew, that's a close one, and I'm back at it. So this business of surrender, when we think about it, what happens that makes that particular collapse, whatever the day of your sobriety date is, what brought that level of grace in? What is that? It's not of me. I've done this a number of times. And so now I'm in here. And the next remarkable thing, when I look about these markers of on this business of, wow, something's going on in this dude's life. The next remarkable thing is from a guy who 30 days previous smoking like a broke stove. I mean, smoking, 40 going north, and can't be trusted. There was an incident, and me and my brothers are tight. I mean, tight. We fight. We talk shit about each other, but you can't. No. And we were in the house this particular time, and we got loaded together, me and my brothers. We boys in every area, and we were smoking, and everybody had their own little packets and something. And one of my brothers got caught slipping, right, and I picked up his pack. And Ronnie was like, anybody see my dope? And everybody's looking and helping look, and you know. And I'm telling you, Miles, this business, the spark in me was still so there. You don't rip off your brother, you know. And it was eating me alive. I was like, damn. This is a line I never thought I'd cross. So me and my brothers, we looking for Ronnie's dope. We looking, and it was eating me. And I couldn't, so I threw it in the corner. And I looked in the corner. Hey, Ronnie, here it is. And the look of disgust that my five brothers all collectively gave me when they looked at me, because everybody, game knows game, right? We all in here looking, and we didn't all look right there. It was in an obvious place in a corner, and I'm holding a little pack up. Ronnie, here's your... And my brothers looked at me, and I was like, shit. Dude, that was a lie. Everybody, you know, I don't know if everybody does, but for me, I have my own lie. I don't even know. You would think that going in the bank and draining that bank account was the line in the sand. But that one, when I burned my brother, that one was like, oh my God, you know. And so I had sunk to that. So this that guy, 30 days later, something happens, and I'm standing in the circle in 9604, and we at the end of the meeting, at the end of reading a vision for you, and we're saying, our Father, and I'm saying it, and I'm feeling it, and I'm knowing it. And I'm home. What is that? 30 days later, picking up Astro, and you cleaning stuff out, you helping, you doing this thing, and it just feels like, what is that? So this business, this second step experience, started happening through me without me being aware of it going on. I had a head start. You know, there are some things that I take credit for in recovery that I don't have no business taking credit for. Some of it I'm built that way. You know, sometimes, for instance, when we get to inventory and we start talking about writing, and some folk be like, a lot of you guys, everybody raised their hand, the sponsor, they're not really doing the work. I am very careful of those kind of judgments, man, because everybody ain't starting at the same place. Some stuff I'm built for. Writing is in my wheelhouse. I'm a writer. That's what I do, you know. And so then I take credit for this business of standing in the circle. And all, it's what I do. I'm built for it. I don't know it. But Ralph White's mom, all these years of connecting me with this power. See, this power is going to reach for me whether I'm reaching for it. I don't even know what's going on. You know, all those many years. So it was like coming home for me. And so I'm resisting and I'm struggling because I got to be right. I'm the right guy. And for me, being right is, it's amazing to me. Because I don't have no dog in this hunt of there is no God. Why would I, what's in that for me? What's in that for me, right? Except to now prove to these old folk, y'all were getting indoctrinated. I'm from the 60s, right? And I'm a cat from the 60s in Watson. You brought these black folks up from the side, and this is what you use in the kingdom. Yeah, I'm all in all that. Where, Ralph, where's your vested interest? Well, I got to be right. You know, granddaddy, I got to be right. You know, I'm a kid, I used to say. And one of the things, you guys, that opened up this path to the second step for me more than anything else, this business of coming to believe, there were two things. One was the witness testimony. I'm a hard-headed guy, and I'm a stubborn guy, and I'm a know-it-all guy, but I'm not a stupid guy. You know, I would go to enough meetings. Kent talked about the meetings he went to. I went 18 months without a job, so I went to 3 meetings a day for probably my first 2 years. My first year and a half, I went to 3 meetings every single day. It was good for me because I was in the life. And for a guy like me, I was in the life. I wasn't working a lot of time, and I was in that all day, every day. So it was good for me. I was going to 3 meetings a day. What happens when you go to those many meetings is you hear a guy come up to the podium and he'll say, my name is Dylan, you know, alcohol had its way with me. I found a power bigger than me. I ain't had a drink or I ain't got loaded in 18 months. You'll get somebody else, you know, my name is Joe, you know, alcohol had its way with me. I found a power bigger than me. I ain't had one in a year. You'll find my name is Jane, and you know, drugs and alcohol had their way with me. I found a power bigger than me. I have not got loaded in 2 years. Not that many. All y'all ain't lying. I'm hard-headed and I'm stubborn. Everybody ain't lying. So the overwhelming evidence, you know, the witness testimony, and that's what happens when we share at our meetings, you guys. If you go to court, and many of you guys have been to court on the wrong side of the docket, you know, if you go to court, you know it's two things that's persuasive in court, and two items, evidence. And evidence can come as documentary evidence. That's his picture. That's his hand right there. That's it. Or witness testimony. And what we get all the time, witness testimony. Witness testimony, you know, and so I was that many meetings, man, you softened me up, you know. And then the other piece that made it easy for me to grab hold of this God idea, in addition to the evidence of my life card to come, was, you know, in We Agnostics, there's a part in there that talks about be quick to see where religious people were right. And see, that was my deal, because I had an overdose, like Dr. Bobby said, an overdose of religious education. I had been, but I was looking at it wrong, right? Be quick to see where religious people are right. LO63992. Some old folk in here remember when phone numbers had letter prefixes. LO63992, that's my grandparents' phone number. They've been dead a long time. My grandparents had one phone number my entire life. I still know it. It was so comforting for me. I knew that number. I don't know nobody's number now, but I knew that phone number, you know. 1726 East 107th Street, one address. That's my grandparents' address. You know, that one address, one phone number. My granddad was a blue-collar guy, not very well educated, but he was a provider. He was my guy. I didn't have a dad, but this man was the example for me. And I remember when I was working in management at this utility company, and I'd be thinking to myself, yeah, I make more in a year than granddaddy probably made in the last 10 years. You know, and it dawned on me when I was reading that chapter, yeah, but granddaddy never asked me for bail money. Be quick to see where religious people are right. You know, my mom was on welfare, and she was raising 6 sons. Can you imagine that? 6. We lived in a little 2-bedroom apartment, my mom and one and the 6 boys in 3 bunk beds in the other room. And as I got, once I became an adult, I would have conversations with my mom sometimes, in sobriety, not prose. And there would be times when my mom didn't know where rent was coming from. She got 6 sons. We didn't have a car. My mom had 6 sons and be 3 or 4 months behind on rent. I've been behind on rent. I know that queasy feeling. I know the anxiety and the anxiousness, where I'm gonna go, what I'm gonna do. So magnify that by a mother, not in the life, not doing scandalously, just going out and cleaning houses and doing the best she can, and got 5 little boys, because we were little when this was happening. No car, we ain't gonna even sleep in a car. Where you gonna go and what you gonna do? And my mom had one mantra, God will make a way. You got to come from one of them backgrounds that I come from, and you'll know, you've heard it a lot. God will make a way. As a kid, I used to think that's the weakest, you know. Really? You better get out there and get it, you know. Really, Mama? That's all you got? But God may, I'm here to tell you and I'm here to report that the white boys never slept on the street. My mama never turned a trick. Don't know what it was and how she made it through all those nights. Don't know. She's told me stories now. And my mom went back to school, went to high school, went back to college. My mom ended up being executive insurance. My mom is, to me, my greatest example. Still a spiritual living. She's 93 years old. My mom is who put in me, you can do and be whatever you want to be, coming from wherever you come from. Not talking and being about it, right? But my mom would say, God will make a way. And would seemingly, with grace, navigate. Because the boy, we never knew this. We never knew that the wolf was at the door. We never knew that we were this close to being on the street. We never knew. Mom never brought it on. Y'all, look at how y'all holding me down. We never knew this business of spiritual living. So when I came to that step right there in my life, be quick to see where religious people are right. They're exhibiting a degree of usefulness, happiness, and stability that you should have been looking for yourself, Mr. Know-it-all, Mr. Shit-talker, Mr. Religion is the opiate of the people I'd rather smoke. You got these shining examples in front of you of what your life without this power looks like. Mama, can you help me? Granddaddy, can you help me? You got that example, and you got the example of people who've been living on this spiritual basis. Which one you gonna do, dude? You ain't stupid. You got it. And wow, it opened up for me, you guys. It opened up for me. All the things I used to think about as stupid, as the things that were the stumbling block, I used to say to myself, you know, the stories that they told in church that I found so far-fetched, I call them myths and fables. Well, The language of spirituality, you guys, the language is storytelling. The language of spirituality, you guys, is rooted in that. It's never been meant to be literal. It's never been because I needed to support my position. I think about it being literal. The stories of Ralph, the light just came on for me. The story of Daniel in the lion's den. How many lion's dens have you been in sobriety and before? And how many times have you been delivered from that lion's den and it wasn't you that did it? I go to the lion's den from time to time right now, and there's a power in my life that has made a way when I didn't see a way. How many times have you been in a situation you can't see your way to the other side of? You don't know how you're going to get through it. You don't know how you're going to get to the other side. And somehow the Red Sea parts and you on the other side and you here to talk about it with a sponsor of yours, or you here to talk about it with somebody. How many times have you been on the other side of the Red Sea and it's part of, oh yeah, that's happened for me. You know, how many times, dude? And all of a sudden that's stuff I saw as myths, fables, you know, stories. That is the language of spirituality, folks. That's the language of grace. You don't put it in, you can't put it in words. We do the best we can, and metaphors are the best way to see this unseeable. It's the best way to wrap my head around that which cannot be comprehended in the way that I, in my three-dimensional thing. It's the best way, you know, get free, you know. And the other thing is, what's my vested interest in holding on to? There ain't no God. How's that working for me? I'm a pragmatic guy at the end of the day, you know. And so for me, those examples were very powerful pieces. And the last piece to this, very last piece, is because when we talk about going into this third step and taking this power into that, I used to wonder, well, but I'm blocked. So how am I taking God into it? Well, I'm blocked from relationship with, but I'm not blocked from seeking. It's the seeking. You know, in the second step, it says, Ralph, as soon as a man can say that he's willing to believe, you know, he's well on his way, he can commence to get results from this, even though you ain't got no understanding of it. You ain't got to have no understanding of it. It's just, okay, I want to know you. And that's enough. Go on, Ken.
Can't call him an alcoholic. Ralph just, he opened up some doors for me. I'm sitting here listening to this, and it was emotional for me listening to him, because so much of that happened to me. Ralph used the word tenderized. Like, I hold the record for reinstatement in the Ebenezer Baptist Church to this day. I have been reinstated. And you always knew when I was coming to get reinstated. You just had to read the newspaper. Oh, can it be in Sunday? They got him again, right? And I would sit in the back with the rest of the guys who was in the paper that week. And then they would have an altar call. The editor, who want to come on down and basically start over, right? And I would get up, everybody look, and I could, big church. Family, the South Side, I make that walk down that aisle, head down. The Green Sisters sat in the third row. I'd get up there and they'd go, wandering child, home at last, right? And then I go down there, they circle up, you know, then I stand in front of the church, you know. And then I go get loaded. And I ain't talking about 2 days later. I'm talking about now. Straight to Cliff's Carryout, Old English 800, a brick of Wild Irish Rose, and rolling dope while I'm driving. What was different this time? What was different when I came in here? Ralph said something about not trying to quit, about trying to avoid consequences that we don't want. I said, when I had the heart attack, God, if you let me live, I never do this again. That was, I just wanted to live. It wasn't that I didn't want to still get loaded. When I left y'all last night, I had been in that car behind Daly's Pub. And something happened in that car. And you know, Ralph said it last night, life is lived forward, understood backward. Something happened in that car. In spiritual appendix 2, it said honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness are the three essentials of recovery, yet these are indispensable. Now, it doesn't say total, complete. It says, but they are indispensable. What happened in that car was desperation. Because after 3 months, I finally know what's wrong with me. I also know through the sharing and the meetings, right, that there's something that can be done about it, right? And that produced something called desperation. I did not want to go in that green door. I call honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness the triplets. All triplets have a mother. The mother of honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness in my life was something called desperation. And it gave birth in that car to just enough honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness to me to go to somebody and say, would you help me? Because I would not do that. Ralph talked about last night when he was talking about sponsors, your fear of rejection. What if they tell me no? What if they tell me no? You know, I've been in a lot of trouble in my life. And every time that I've been in trouble, it involved alcohol and drugs. Every time. You know, back in the day, the courts used to send people to treatment. You know, they used to recommend, you know. Out of all the times that I've been in trouble, 7 convictions for driving under the influence of alcohol, I never had a judge say, you have a problem with alcohol and drugs, you need to go get some help. Not one single time. Yet everybody else, people that went in there once got that. Why? Okay? And my first sponsor said, God knows you don't need to. God knows you don't need to. Maybe I would have come and would not have come back. I don't know. I'm not even going to speculate on something like that because I got no idea. But I didn't see this until I had been, I'm not going to try to explain how God do what God do. I saw this when it was time for me to see it. Ralph talked about, you know, see, like, I'm an intellect guy. My sponsor, Bob, he says to me all the time, he said, Ken, it ain't what you don't know that's your problem. He said, it's what you think you know is the problem. He said, because that's what you act on. And he said, and that's why these things happen to you. It's what you think you know. I was a very good student. I was a National Merit Scholar. I was in the National Honor Society. I graduated in the biggest class Sandusky High School ever had. We was the end of the baby boom. I was accepted into Ivy League schools. And I always believe the smartest guy wins. I hung my hat on that. And you know, growing up, I was the guy who stood up on the holidays at church and I could recite entire chapters out the Bible. My mother didn't give me like they do their little speeches. I would do entire chapters and I could do it. That's a gift that's not of me, but that was something that I could do. My mother was ahead of the youth fellowship. We used to do these repeating of Bible verses, you know, over and over and over and over. And those are the verses that when I drive to work every day now, that's what I do. Ralph said, homecoming. When I got to what I want to say just real quick about the chapter to the agnostic. I believe it's the most beautiful piece of spiritual literature that I've ever read. I believe it should be put in every mailbox on the face of this earth. And I said that to my sponsor one time. And you know what he said? Do it. You know what my first thought was? How much would that postage cost me? Right? Always had to be about me. I ain't trusting God with nothing. It's that Kent got to do it, right? But the purpose of that chapter is not to convince me of anything. It is to open my mind to the possibility. That is it. That is all. It is to open my mind to the possibility. The beauty of it is that it will meet me anywhere that I'm at. Ralph talked about the spectrum of experience that people have coming in here. God does not make too hard turns with those who seek him. The realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, and all-inclusive. Listen, this saved my life. Because I had created this narrow vision of what needed to happen in order to have what Ralph talked about, relationship with. And I didn't qualify. I did not qualify. That's why I was disappointed when I came to AA, because I had never been here and I read the steps. Now, I'm not stupid. God. Nope. Been there, done that. Right? I'm going to have to figure out how to do that, but I'm smarter than everybody in here. I'm smarter than, don't you know where I went to school? Smarter than everybody in here. I told my sponsor we could skip the chapter to the agnostic. He said, really? He said, why is that? I said, it's because I'm not agnostic. I'm Baptist. He looked at me and he said, oh, I beg to differ. He said, what you are is a functional agnostic. Now, I was offended by that. I didn't know what it meant, but I didn't like the sound of it. And I said, would you tell me what that is? And he said, sure. He said, that's a person who professes to believe in God, but who lives like there ain't one. Couldn't argue that. Ralph talked about, and he hit me with this one. The two things, and I saw the same two things. I said last night, I heard them stories in here Stephen King couldn't make up, but I heard the end of them stories, and all of them is that they got a power greater than themselves in their lives, and that's why they had the lives they had now. Again, I don't know too much, but I heard that, and I heard it day after day after day after day. Go to meetings. You knew it. You go to meetings. You all go to meetings. They need you in the meetings. Think I need them more now than I did before. But I heard that over and over. So I saw the power of example in here. I used to go to meetings with people who were in AA when it was very new. And they were old. I mean, they were really old. I used to go to Cleveland, and there was a man, his name was Vic Zublik. And Vic Zublik got sober in 1941. And he used to speak for an hour like this. A solid hour. I'm telling you, he did. He never took his arms down. Vic Zublik was a giant in AA. These are cats that ran with Dr. Bob. These are cats that had Bill Wilson on speed dial, didn't think nothing of it. My grand sponsor was Neil C. Neil's sponsor was Bob Smith, a doctor in Akron, the co-founder of AA. That was my great grand sponsor. That's how close I was to this thing. They didn't talk about that stuff. They just people. They flawed people just like us. And Neil never talked about it, that Dr. Bob was his sponsor. And when I found that out from my sponsor, I asked him about it, and he said, yeah, what about it? I said, would you tell me about him? And he told me some things. I'm not going to get into all that now, but a very good doctor. Let's put it like this. Dr. Bob was cool. He was very cool. Dr. Bob was cool. And I had the privilege of being managing trustee of Dr. Bob's home in Akron for 20 years. I just stepped down from that a couple years ago. And that was like a personal thing to me. But the power of example from those people who came to meetings, barely could get around, but they came and they shared with us. I'm gonna go here real quick. I moved back in my mom and dad's house because I didn't have a safe environment in which to live. And it struck me when Ralph was talking. My father said to me, "We're gonna let you back in here." Now, I had been barred from their home because when my grandfather was a wealthy man, and my grandparents lived with us when we grew up, my mom's mom and dad and my father's father. My father's father, him and a couple guys, owned one of my uncles, they owned a coal mine in Pennsylvania. And they sold it when I was in high school, and they got very wealthy. And my grandfather was, he wasn't a man to trifle with. If I asked my grandfather for $5, my grandfather would get that wallet out, blow the cobwebs off it, search through the hundreds, 50s, and 20s to find a five, hand it to me, and he'd say, "Boy, I want my money back." And see, my grandfather wasn't playing. But when I was in shackles in Toledo, Ohio, looking at about 150 years in the penitentiary, it was my grandfather who got me the best lawyer in Ohio, and I was able to not go to prison for that. Should have. My grandfather used to say to me, "Boy, come and sit down, I'm gonna predict your future." My grandfather was a great man, and my grandfather died, and okay, I know how much money he kept in that wallet. He used to cash my income tax checks out his wallet, right? So my grandfather's in the hospital for the last time. And so this is my thought: where's the wallet? Now, I know he don't trust people, so the wallet is not at the hospital. That ain't happening. The wallet is in the house. Okay, where is the wallet in the house? My father had a strong box. Bet you money the wallet is in the strong box. Okay, how are we gonna get into the strong box? Well, when they go to the hospital to visit, they would go at 6 o'clock, my mom and dad. I will sneak into the house, I will pick the lock on the strong box, and I will get me a couple dollars. Okay. I hit the box 2-3 times till I took all of it. And my mother called me. I put it to you like this. She didn't call me. She got word to me because you couldn't call me. I didn't have a phone. She got word to me. "I need to see you." And I went in there and my mother said, "Where's the money?" And I said, "What money? Why is it every time something happened, y'all got to be looking for me?" My mother said, "We have a short list of suspects." When something happened, matter of fact, "You the only name on that list." My mother said, "I want that money back, and I don't want you ever to come here again." Right? So But I looked at my mom and daddy. My mom and daddy freed themselves from me, and they did it without Al and I. I went over there one day, and they used to like to go to Canada to get away from me. They felt like they wanted to leave the country. I'm not lying to you. They would go to London, Ontario, Canada for weekends. They would go shopping. They would stay in a nice hotel to be the hell away from me. And I went over there one Friday because I had concocted a story. You know, I done smoked a check up. I had it must have been a pretty good story for me to even go over there, because I wasn't allowed over there. And the garage door was open, and the Cadillac was backing out. I'm standing in the driveway, right, as the car is backing out. My mother leaned her head out the window and said, boy, you better move. And the car kept coming. I jumped in the bushes. Off they went. Listen, my mom and daddy didn't have to have permission of the state of Ohio to lead a state. My mama and daddy didn't have to get a pistol and put it in the car to go get gas. My mom and daddy could answer their telephone without having to know who it was who was calling. My mom and daddy lived free. They was happy. They was joyous. They was free. And I ridicule people like that. When Jim and Tammy Faye Baker hit the wall, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker had this resort down in North Carolina. And I always said they was crooks, because that's me. I'm a judger, right? And when that was on the news, I ran over there. Told you, right? that's how I just, when I was in high school, you know, I made the decision a lot of people make, I ain't never again gonna darken the door of no church. And I didn't unless I felt it would somehow benefit me. That's how I would go back to get reinstated. And so what was different this time? What was different this time is what happened to me in that car. Because this time, when we started to go through this, what I realized is that this narrow pathway that I had created to have God in some way in my life, our book said, no. Broad, roomy, all inclusive. And then I listened to the stories in here, right? And I realized that everybody was in a different place. But God will meet you where you are. God is going to will meet you wherever you are. I sponsor a lot of people like Ralph does. I sponsor a Catholic priest who is older, who's sober longer than me. I sponsor a Baptist minister who I've sponsored since he was new. He's coming up on, I think, like 28 years. And then I sponsor people who had absolutely no background or training or anything at all, right? And the principles apply. It's very interesting. Both of my sponsors, Bill and Kenny, my first sponsors, were both Catholic. Kenny was Eucharistic minister in the Catholic Church, in a huge Catholic church in Cleveland. When Kenny died, there's probably 2,000 people in that church. And the priest who had been there 40 years, now Kenny was sober 50, the priest got up and he said, in the last 40 years, he said, I have called Kenny about somebody who had a problem with alcohol and drugs. 40 years, he said, do you have any idea how many hundreds of calls I made to him in with a congregation of this size? And he said, Kenny, all he ever said was, I'll be right there. Never once did he say, I don't have time or I'll get to it later. He said, I'll be right there. These are the people that helped me. So this came to believe. Ralph hit the line. Do I now believe, or am I even willing? See, there's an or in there. I don't have to believe nothing. Am I even willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself? And it said, if so, do we emphatically assure you you're on your way? I just finished doing this chapter in my book study with I have a sponsee line Zoom meeting. We just finished. We do 1 week out the month. We get into some book. And we just did We Agnostics. And to get people to talk about this, I'm not a sponsor who sit and read to you and think, no, this is a two-way, let's talk about this. I need to know how this play out. I share how it play out with me. I get it. All, it has to be internalized. It's not intellectual. It has to be real in my experience. I have to see how this is real for me. Not for Ralph, not for Kent. How is this real for me? And that's the way it was done for me. So, you know, step two, one and two, it said being convinced, right? A, B, and C. Alcoholic and can I manage my own life? Covered that last night. Probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and see that God could and would if, and Ralph said it, if he were sought. So what am I coming out of two with? Seeking. Seeking. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore, greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I was not restored to sanity in the second step, and it doesn't say that. I came to believe there's a power greater than me that could do that. See, there's a difference, isn't there? See, I looked at it, I'm thinking, like, I'm supposed to get sane now, but in step 10 and 11, they start to talk about it this, before by this time, sanity will have returned. So what happened? A whole bunch more steps, that's what happened. Right? So I just come to believe that, and I'm going to put it like this, that this could be possible for me. That's all. And I would say 80% of that came from the power of y'all's example and your stories. I'd say 80% of it. Yes, I did look at the fact that my life was full of people who lived spiritual life. You know, looking back now, it's amazing. There was two ladies at work at Ford, and they was inspectors. And they still both alive, and they retired long before I did, but they used to come by and they used to say, Kent, we praying for you. One night they came by and they said, Kent, you're turning gray. You need to get some help. That was a week before I had the heart attack. And I was in a Kohl's department store at home and I heard a voice behind me. It was Miss Leona. And she was like, Kent, how long are you sober now? And I said, 31 years. And she said, God is great. They prayed for me. So I was surrounded by, and my family is just wonderful, wonderful people. I felt like a preacher's kid because of the status that my mother had. My mother was down here a lot. My mother knew a lot of the people in the civil rights movement, and those are people that my mother knew. There were people that were in the living room in my mother and father's house that you have seen on television. And so I always, you know how it is, like, I want to be cool. I don't want to be that, right? I don't want to be known as that. You know, I can remember when I first started getting out in the street some, and I'd be somewhere, they'd be smoking weed, they'd be like, oh, no, nah, Coleman here, don't pass that to him, right? Like, I remember those days, right? And step two, right? I became convinced. Made a decision, and we'll start on this, and then we're gonna shut down till, take our break, I think till 10:30. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. Made a decision. I don't know if anybody else in here like me, but I thought the third step was some kind of conversion experience. In church, they used to talk about being saved, right? Like being saved. Like I was like this one day, and then boom. Right, I got saved and I was like this. Now God is everything, right? And so when I looked at step three, I didn't see the made a decision. I just saw to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. And I'm like, I'm not capable of that. And I wasn't capable of that. That's why I'm making a decision. Every morning, I make a decision to go to work. I make that decision when my alarm clock goes off and I'm laying in the bed. When I make that decision to go to work, I am not Star Trek teleported to my office. There's some things that take place before I go to work, right? I get up, I take my shower, do my reading, my prayer, my meditation, get my coffee, get my briefcase, and out the door, drive to work. In order for the decision to come true, there is action that has to take place. What is the action that turns my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand them, the remaining steps? It is a decision, right? Now, our book goes into a lot of detail about why this decision needs to be made. My life run on my will, right? Let's take a look at Kent's track record. Okay. Well, it would go something like this. Kent's life run on Kent's will equals pajamas and paper shoes. That was the best I come up with in 32 years of living, was pajamas, paper shoes, and detox. And a whole lot of other mess in between. The third step, it is a decision. And so the book goes on and it talks about stuff that, right, I'm not going to get into all that. What I would say is when I got to the third step, I'm still, really not clear on what this is. I know there's a third step prayer. My sponsor is talking to me about what this is and what, but somehow I don't know, I just couldn't hear him. And I was at work, and at this point, like, I'm like, I want what y'all got. And I know that this has to be done. But I'm still kind of thinking there has to be some kind of lightning bolt in here somewhere, right? And so he said, we're gonna get together on Saturday, and we're gonna do the third step prayer, right? And then I'm going to get you moving on your inventory. Well, I did not want to half do this. I wanted to do it right. But it still ain't sitting right with me. And it's a true story. I was at work. I worked midnights. And there was a little closet bathroom. Y'all know them little dinky bathroom, got a toilet and a sink in it. And that was where I used to smoke crack at work. I also drank in there. And I went in that bathroom, and I closed the door, and I took some paper towels, and I put them down on the floor, and I got on my knees. And everything that was going on in my life at that moment, y'all know how the credits of a movie roll at the end of a movie? Rolled through my head. My mother was dying. My mother had bone cancer. My mother was dying. I was tens of thousands of dollars in debt. I was in trouble with the law. I was still in trouble at work. At this point, what, 4 months sober, maybe 4.5 months sober. And I don't know what's going to happen to me. And on my knees in that bathroom, I said, God, please do whatever it is that you want to do. I'm done. There has to be more to life than this. I can't do this anymore. I'm done. And I got off my knees and I walked out of that bathroom. Is that when I took the third step? I suspect so, at least in spirit. And I've never got back on my knees and said, God, you did a lousy job. I gave you a shot. The kid is back. what I will tell you is that I get in the way a lot. And we'll talk about this stuff a little bit later. But the progression of recovery, We talk about the progression of alcoholism. Recovery is progressive also. And, you know, I don't want to get into a whole bunch of stuff, but, you know, I hear stuff like who got the most sobrieties, who got up first today, and all kinds of stuff like that. Now, I don't believe that. There are some things that come with being here for some time. And one of them is that I recognize much quickly when I get in the way, and I am willing to do what I need to do to get out of the way a whole lot quicker than what I used to. I don't stay in it as long as I used to. There are some times, because there are some things that I struggle with. But there is an increased sensitivity to the condition of my spirit. There's an increased sensitivity to, I like feeling good. I like being on the sunny side of the street. I don't like being scared. I don't like being worried. I don't like being judgmental. I don't like being angry. I don't like talking about people behind their back. That do not mean I will not do those things. But I am no longer comfortable with that. And it's funny, because when I do it, I get this funny feeling in my stomach. It's like, this is not what I want to do. It's not what I want to be. It's one of the reasons that I got off social media, is because one of my biggest problems is judgment. And see, I don't want to see things that interfere with my primary purpose of loving and serving you. I do not want that to happen. I don't care about who you vote for. I don't care about what kind of car you drive. I don't care about none of that. My first sponsor taught me something. He said, the only thing you think about when you see another child of God is, how may I assist you? How may I assist you? That's it. That's it. So I got off of that. And it was like, I went through detox of Facebook for about like 2 weeks. And then you know what? It has not crossed my mind since. I want to be positioned to live my purpose here. I love that old saying, the two most important days in a man's life, the day he's born and then the day he finds out why. I know why I'm here. And that is to love and to serve. I don't always do it, of course. But I know why I'm here. And I want to be free enough of me to do that. And that comes from following steps. When we come back, I'm sure Ralph gonna go into some more on 3, and then we hopefully can get some 4 and 5 in also. So let's take our break. We'll see you back here, I believe, at 10:30.